I'm Christopher Light, and this is The Connection. God, Darwin, creation, evolution, either or, neither both. And can the truth of the matter really be different in public schools and private schools? The argument is antique and widely derided by now, but it flares anew on the edges of the American Bible Belt. The Kansas School Board voted last summer to get evolution out of the state science curriculum. Biology textbooks in Oklahoma have added a disclaimer referring to evolution as a controversial theory. Kentucky has stripped the word evolution from the curriculum, replacing it with the phrase change over time. The first threat in this fight 150 years ago seemed to be that Darwin's account of the origin of species would drive God out of the picture. The recurrent threat in this country is that the creation story could drive science out of education. Our guest, Kenneth Miller, is a religious biologist who says the good guys in this fight are God and Darwin, and that almost everybody else may be wrong. Connection listeners, how do you answer your own kids' questions about our ape connection, for example, or say the Garden of Eden? Can you answer the two questions together? Or are these different stories for different days? Ken Miller says that variation and selection, otherwise known as evolution, are the best story we have of how it all happened, but it hasn't poisoned the garden of his belief in a creative God. He's a biology professor at Brown University and an orthodox Darwinian, he says, meaning that he thinks he's found, as in the title of his new book, Darwin's God. Give him a call at 1-800-423-8255 or 1-800-423-TALK. Welcome.
Thank you.
Ken Miller. First off, why is it, wherever people stand on this thing, we just plain love to fight about it and to fight about it in our own heads, by ourselves?
I think the reason is because it cuts so close to home. I think it's the same reason you can start a fight in a bar by saying something about somebody's mother or father. We all want to know the story.
What do you mean I'm related to an ape?
Bingo. We all want to know the story. We all want to understand how do we fit into the scheme of things, not just in our own communities, but in the past. And all of us, in a sense, have a sense of where we fit in. And evolution is something that, for a lot of people, disrupts that sense of self and that sense of place. And therefore, it's a powerful idea, and it's an idea with enormous implications, and to which a lot of people have fundamental visceral resistance.
Is it still a legitimate argument? I mean, do we know what this fight is about? Is it worth the fray? Is it worth all these legislative deliberations?
Oh, I think it's more than worth the fray, because what's at stake isn't just evolution. It's not just 6 days in the biology curriculum. It's not a chapter of a textbook with many, many, many subjects. What's at stake is the whole issue of scientific integrity. And one of the things that's worth noting, you mentioned the fact that Kansas had deleted evolution from the statewide required curriculum. Well, they didn't stop there. They also deleted Big Bang cosmology, and there are people who are pressuring them to delete further. They want them to delete most of geology from the earth science curriculum in middle school. They'd like them to delete the standard understanding of the second law of thermodynamics from the way in which chemistry is taught. Mm. So evolution is sort of like the canary in the mine shaft, which is if the canary falls over, all of the sciences are in trouble.
What do you worry about? I mean, are you worrying here about us as a scientist about sort of rational modern knowledge being driven out of the public space, or are you still worried about God's place here?
I'm not. I'm worried about both. I mean, as a scientist, naturally, I worry about the former statement. More than that, I'm concerned about the fact that we are beginning the most scientific and technical century that our species has ever seen, and we're in a competitive world. And so far, this country has done very well in that competitive world, in part because in the aftermath of Sputnik in the 60s, there was an enormous appreciation of the value of science and math education in American high schools and colleges as well. We haven't kept up with that. The rest of the world has figured out that's a good idea. And what my principal concern as an educator is that these considerations are going to drive not just one subtopic of evolution, but they're going to compromise the general teaching of science as well. And then the other thing, which I'm concerned about, and we can elaborate on this later, is that putting science in direct opposition to religion is damaging to both. It's especially damaging to religion.
Meaning what?
Well, let me put it this way. One of the things that you often hear people ask when they talk about what should be in the public school curriculum, should we teach evolution or not? They say, well, why can't we teach both? Why can't we teach the other side of the story, the other idea, and that other idea being creationism or so-called scientific creationism? Well, there's an interesting thing that happens if you actually do that, and that is by teaching both, you change evolution from a biological theory, which is essentially neutral on religion, to one which is always made to compare and contrast conventional religious belief. In other words, you mutate evolution into something that is inherently hostile to religion by setting up two sides of the issue. And by so doing, you make science inherently hostile to religion. And scientists everywhere will tell you that just isn't the case.
Well, that's been the line, it seems to me. We've done many, many programs on aspects of this with the likes of Richard Dawkins and Steve Gould and Dan Dennett and E.O. Wilson and Chet Ramo most recently. Actually, the last thing we did about it was a kind of celebration with Steve Gould of Franz Joseph Haydn's oratorio, The Creation, written 200 years ago, a very orthodox, straight musical setting of the first book of Genesis, in which Steve Gould, at the drop of a hat, loves to take part.
And take part with gusto.
With gusto, yeah, and a pretty good baritone sound, apparently. What I sense, though, in a lot of discussion, including from listeners, is very much where you're heading, which is trying to embrace a kind of human understanding that encompasses both disciplines in a fashion. Is this splitting the difference? Is it having your cake and eating it too? Or is it sort of reapproaching some sort of pre-Enlightenment higher truth, do you think?
Well, I'll go for the last. It sounds best. It certainly isn't splitting the difference. And what I mean by that, it's not an issue of saying, well, here's an extreme view on one side, and there's an extreme view on the other. So therefore, let's take the middle ground. And in science, where you often have to choose between theoretical alternatives, the middle ground is often dead wrong. It's important to understand in science, unlike the humanities, very often you really do settle questions occasionally. At least you discard alternatives. So I don't think that's it. I think what's important is that evolutionary biology in particular, and science in general, be understood properly. And what I mean by that is that one of the things that makes people afraid, I think, of evolution is the way in which evolutionary ideas have been extrapolated into the social and the psychological and the political spectrum, in the political arena, in such a way to make evolution into a fundamentally anti-theistic idea. People see that, and they see that in the writings of many leading evolutionary biologists.
Dan Dennett is that way. I mean, he is a strictly algorithmic evolutionist who says there's just plain no room for an all-powerful God in that game.
And he's made that very clear in his terrific book, Darwin's Dangerous Idea, which I read frequently and much admire, and is an extraordinarily lucid book.
What's wrong with his argument?
Well, the book is extraordinarily lucid, and his arguments are good in terms of explaining how evolutionary biology can generate complexity, can generate novelty, how natural selection can be a creative force. He does that extremely well. But then what he does basically is to say, look, by providing answers to these fundamental questions, we haven't left anything for God to do. And then in his view, he views religion in general, as fundamentally anti-intellectual. And at one point he actually says that he looks forward to the days in which religions will be put in cages so that they can't harm the people in larger society. Now, Dennett's just the philosopher. So knowing a few philosophers, I realize that his cages are just theoretical constructs. But, you know, it leaves you scratching your head. The 20th century has a long history of putting people with unpopular beliefs behind bars. And I know that's not what he means. But that metaphor to a religious person says, hey, this is a frightening idea. This is a smart guy. And if he says that's what evolution means, I certainly don't want my kids being taught it.
What's wrong with his argument? How do you argue back?
Oh, well, you argue back in a very simple way, and that is to say, look, what you have done is to take very good science up to a point and then say, now I am going to require that science generate theological conclusions. And that's exactly what he does in that argument. If I was to, on the basis of the work that I do in cell and molecular biology, or on the basis of my graduate training in chemistry and physics, if I was to say that by examining the physical nature of the universe and scientific findings, I had found proof for the existence of God, I had found a scientific way to derive order and meaning in the universe, most of my colleagues at a scientific meeting would start snickering and say, he's lost it. The ironic thing is that people like Dan Dennett think they can do exactly the opposite and still be scientifically sound. In other words, he might say, you know, you're a fool if you think you can use science to detect purpose to the universe, but I'm being a rigorous scientist when I say that science tells us that the universe has no meaning and no purpose. And I think either conclusion would be scientifically and logically invalid.
That's your argument with the sort of openly anti-religious, no room for God, evolutionary scientists or philosophers in Dan Dennett's case. How would you sum up your argument with the Kansas Board of Education types who basically want to drive science out of the classroom too?
Well, the first of all, this is the easier argument to sum up. And the book that that I've written is just published, called Finding Darwin's God, really devotes about half of its bulk to taking on the sort of standard arguments that you hear against evolution one at a time and trying to dispose of them in a very scientific fashion. So the first question is very simple. Is there a scientific case to be made against any aspect of evolutionary theory? And you can take those arguments one at a time, a biochemical case against it, a logical case against it, sort of a physical sciences case against it, and the answer is no. Evolutionary biology simply is one of the strongest, most vigorous, most well-developed fields of science we have. As Dobzhansky said, and everyone quotes, nothing biology makes sense except in light of evolution. And I think that's absolutely true. So what the Kansas Board of Education has done is literally to tear the heart out of the unifying principle that ties everything in biology together. Can I give you an example that's right out of the news? And I think all teachers like to pull something out of the headlines and bring it into their science classes and say, hey, look at this. It turns out that 3 or 4 weeks ago, a group of researchers at Duke University published a very interesting paper in which they showed that there were scars, that's the only way to describe them, there were scars of retroviral DNA that are found in human DNA. And that means that at some point in the past, all humans have these little DNA sequences related to a retrovirus. And that means at some point in the past, a common ancestor in our species was infected by this retrovirus. It left its DNA calling cards behind. These little segments are still active in some cases. Now, the researchers decided, why stop there? Let's look at some other primates. And what they discovered is that all of the primates known as old world primates have identical scars. And what that tells them is that this is a remnant of an ancient infection that occurred about 30 million years ago, before the line leading to other higher primates and our own line diverged. And as the researchers, very straightforward scientific conclusion, said, this is very good evidence of the fact, as if we needed more, very good evidence of the fact that we share a common ancestry with our primate ancestors. Now, how do you explain that in Kansas? In other words, you can't teach evolution. How do you explain that you have these identical smudges? It would be like me as a teacher collecting papers from my students and discovered that the two of them had the same pattern of mistakes. Well, any reasonable teacher would say, hey, those papers have a common source, kids, you copy. That's exactly what you've got here, a common pattern of mistakes. But again, in Kansas, you can't explain that. It's an inexplicable fact in the news.
1-800-423-8255. Our guest is Kenneth Miller, professor of biology at Brown University. His new book is called Finding Darwin's God. His answer when students ask him, do you believe in God, is yes. What kind of God? He says, Darwin's God. You quote that beautiful conclusion of Darwin's Origin of Species. It's a marvelous piece of English prose. He refers to the creator of the original forms with the spin on it, the spin on creation that keeps creating a multiplicity of other forms. I wonder if that's the only way to read that. In any case, we'll come back to it. The point is, in Ken Miller's view, that Darwin left plenty of room in his understanding of evolution for a creative big guy, and he's there very much in Ken Miller's world, too. 1-800-423-8255. Dan Dennett is on the line, professor of philosophy at Tufts University. Your name's been taken in vain, Dan Dennett.
Good morning, Chris.
If by rights, it's your turn here.
Good morning, Professor.
I'm delighted to respond to Ken Miller. I'm very pleased with what he had to say about my book. I want to try to correct one impression that he has about my opinion of religion. The passage where I said that religion should be put in cages has been hit upon by many religious people as showing how fundamentally anti-religion I am. But if you look closely at the passages, what I'm saying is that sometimes when it's absolutely necessary, when we have religions that are violent or that violate our moral beliefs in some way, we don't permit it. And I'm sure Professor Miller agrees that there are bounds beyond which religious freedom will not permissibly go. And it's only in those conditions that I said, when it's absolutely necessary, we have to restrict religious practices.
We'll let you go in the cages, Dan Dennett. Do we have it right, though, that your view of the way evolution works just simply doesn't leave room for a creative God?
Well, it leaves room in an almost vanishing and evaporated sense. By the time you believe in a God who is not a personal God, who is not a purposeful God, who does not have a mind, who is just a sort of principle of goodness in the universe, well, that's fine. If that's all that Darwin's God is, that's fine.
And it's certainly, I would concur with you that if you believe in a God like that, it doesn't mean a whole lot. It's sort of like what Carl Sagan said. It's about as moving as praying to the law of gravity.
Yeah.
But that's not the kind of God that I'm arguing for. And the theology that I try to examine in my book is whether or not what most people would agree is a traditional Western view of God. And by Western, I mean broadly construed Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, a personal God, an active God. Is that compatible with what we understand about evolutionary biology? And the general sense is the one that you're crystallizing now so well, which is it's not. And what I tried to do is take the ideas apart and see whether or not what we really understand about evolution is compatible. And I think it is. And I think it is in a very fundamental way. In many respects, and I'll just give you an example of why I think the current formulations that many philosophers of evolutionary biology, the current spin which they put on it, is dangerous, not just to science, not just to religion, but also to science. And I will quote you, because to be perfectly honest, you're more circumspect and more reasonable about this. But I'll cite Bill Provine, who's a historian of science at Cornell. He's a great guy, and he does very interesting work. He wrote that modern science directly implies that there are no inherent moral or ethical laws, no absolute guiding principles for human society. Now, a lot of people think that that's overstating scientific conclusion, and I'm glad you agree with me on that.
I think that's true. I think that there's plenty of room for a really developed account of Western morality, and for there to be meanings to life that go beyond the merely biological. And that's why I had that subtitle on my book, The Evolution and the Meanings of Life, to insist that evolution does not leave us without ethics. It does not leave us without beauty. What I still think, though, is that it leaves no work for a personal God to do.
And that's where I fundamentally disagree with you.
Okay,
that's exactly right. And that's one of the things.
Make your case, Dan Dennett, and I want Ken Miller to respond.
Well, let's just sort of follow the retreat. One starts with a God, a handicrafter God, a God who actually makes every beast and every plant, all creatures great and small, fashions them with his own hands. He's got hands. Well, we get rid of that idea, and we say that we have the God who simply sets the laws of nature very precisely, and then evolution and the second law of thermodynamics is over, takes care of the further developments. This is not a handicrafter God, but a lawgiver God. But now the lawgiver God in turn can be replaced by a God who is simply the, as it were, the law finder God, where we imagine in concert with various contemporary cosmologists that there may be other universes which have different so-called constants, where the laws of nature are somewhat different, and the fact that life evolves in a universe where it is possible for life to evolve is just, of course, trivial. So now we have a God who's not even really a lawgiver.
What you're doing is setting together a series of formulations of weaker and weaker gods, none of which I agree with. But we still haven't explained, or you still haven't explained scientifically, why you pick one of those gods. In other words, what's the conclusion from science that says what must be what God is like?
I think we can agree on one thing more, and I'm happy that you stress it, and I'm happy to stress it with you, and that is science doesn't imply any one of these weaker gods. Science is simply neutral with regard to them. However, that very fact shows that it is a gratuitous, scientifically gratuitous, move on the part of anybody to insist on one of those.
Well, it's
ad lib. Yes, you can't prove it's not there, but you have you've removed all grounds for insisting on it.
You certainly have, and I wouldn't argue for a second that anybody can scientifically prove the existence of God, or for that matter, that anybody could scientifically disprove it. The question I wanted to ask is larger, and that is the traditional Western conception of God, a personal God, somebody who can intervene in human affairs, somebody who hears your prayers, someone who provides moral order to the universe and so forth, is that consistent with what we understand about evolutionary biology? And I think the answer to that on every score is yes. Now, the sorts of gods, the sorts of conceptions that you've talked about, the handicrafter or the lawgiver gods, these are gods these conceptions relate to a very primitive understanding of what a supreme being has to be like. And if you take conventional Western theology these days, there's no need to presuppose a god for whom every natural event requires an expression of the will of God. God isn't up there straining to make daisies bloom. He's not pulling the sun across the sky. He's not worrying about which of the cells in your trachea is about to go through mitosis right now. What that God has done is to set up a materially self-sufficient universe. Now, if you take it a little bit further and you ask the following question, one of the other things those religions have in common is free will. In other words, the ability of human beings to make authentic moral choices. How do you build, suppose you take the position of God, how do you build a universe in which free beings have free will, have the right to do that? Well, in a sense, the only way to do that is to give them an independent material existence. There's nothing about that that basically keeps God from intervening in ways that are effective, but nonetheless undetectable.
I think we agree further that free will in the morally important sense is quite consistent with evolutionary biology, with materialism.
I agree.
This is something that I've been working on in the past and I'm working on now. So our agreements are really very, very widespread. There's just one, as I see it now. I haven't read your book yet, by the way. I'm looking forward to it.
Thank you.
I would grant that there is a sense of consistency in which a whole panoply of different conceptions of Western conceptions of God are consistent with everything that we can learn from science.
I think that's an important message to get across.
Well,
I don't want you to agree beyond real agreement here, Dan.
Well,
Dana, just
hang
to
on,
be polite.
Let me just finish the sentence. I know you want there to be some controversy here, and believe me,
you can't throw anything from a telephone. But go ahead.
here comes the but.
Okay.
Consistency is cheap, and even though many different Western conceptions of God are entirely officially, logically consistent with science, science removes all trace of motivation for believing in most of those. So that if you do go on and believe in one of those gods, you do so confident that you're not inconsistent, but with no shred of evidence on your side. It's also consistent with everything we know in science that there are 17 invisible gremlins inhabiting the cylinder of every internal combustion engine. They cannot be seen by X-rays. They have no mass. There's no inconsistency there. It's just a foolish idea, of course.
That's exactly right. But to compare religious belief, Islam, Judaism, Christianity, to the gremlins in the Car Talk guy's number one cylinder is stretching it to the point of ridiculousness. What I'm talking about consistency, and it's important to remember that the entire Western religious tradition, in many respects, is what gave rise to Western science to begin with. It's important to understand that the whole idea of a Western personal God, the whole idea of a creator who wanted individual people to be in existence is consistent with this. Now, you say you can't prove it from science, and you're acknowledging you can't disprove it either. That's fine. But it's important to make the point that religion, it construed in the most orthodox sense, is entirely consistent with evolutionary biology. Religious people, Dan, inevitably find religious belief for reasons that don't have anything to do with science. And what is irresponsible, and I didn't say you're doing it, I'm just saying what is irresponsible for people to do is to pretend that on the basis of science in general, and evolutionary biology in particular, we can do away with that.
Ben Dennett, you want a last word in 30 seconds?
Well, I think I agree with everything that Ken just said. That is to say, I think it is. I agree with him that it is a mistake, and a serious mistake, for scientists or philosophers of science to overreach and to assert that science proves that the Western religion is just false. I think that's a mistake. It's a diplomatic error. It's gratuitous. There's no point in saying that.
It's more than diplomacy. It's an error of logic.
Dan Dennett, we're going to take a break. Thank you enormously for joining us on The Connection and sharpening the question. We're talking with biology professor Kenneth Miller from Brown University about his new book called Finding Darwin's God. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston and PRI Public Radio International. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Evolution Connection.
Grace wells, and every living creature that moves, and God bless them, saying, if good for
this is the music of Franz Joseph Haydn, the oratorio The Creation, and the words of the opening chapter of the book of Genesis, in which God created whales and every living creature that moveth, and told them, be fruitful all and multiply. We're talking about the age-old argument about evolution and creation. Stephen Jay Gould, the evolutionary biologist Ken Miller, was talking with us about this Haydn oratorio, which he takes glorious part whenever he can, just before Christmas, and he was celebrating both in a fashion. He was certainly saying there's no inherent conflict between believing both, and yet there is also a certain edge of dismissal, I think.
I agree, and I think the edge of dismissal comes out very clearly in writings of Will Provine, who I've quoted, Richard Dawkins, who's a marvelous writer on evolutionary theory, but whose inveterate hostility to religion shows in almost everything he writes, and to some extent, despite his qualifications, to the passages that we were talking about in Dan Dennett's book, in terms of the suspicion and the hostility and the dismissiveness of religion. Comparing, for example, the Western God to the gremlins in an automobile engine is going to be understood by most religious people as an insulting comparison.
Well, let me ask you, you've forgotten more about DNA and the history of these organisms than I'll ever know. And you would agree that it is an integrated, sustained, enormously persuasive account of the way life works. Why do you reapproach the Genesis story and the Christian, Judeo-Christian understanding of this stuff in a non-dismissive mode yourself? What is the charm of it for you?
What you're really asking me, and a lot of people have asked me this since the book appeared, comes out of a sense of disappointment that the book doesn't have 10 reasons to believe in it in terms of an outright endorsement of religion. And what I wanted to do in the book is actually something different, and that is to start as many people do who are religious, from the presumption of belief, and then say, is there something that has come out of Darwin, something that's come out of evolutionary biology that either challenges that belief or reaffirms it? And what I find when it's carefully examined, it reaffirms it. It doesn't challenge it at all. You asked about Genesis. One of the interesting things about Genesis is there's more than one way to read it. Even people who describe themselves as biblical literalists, and they simply say it means that every word of Genesis is to be taken literally, such people produce so many books on the interpretation of Scripture that tells me that if interpreting is so straightforward, why do you have to write so much interpretation? And just to take as an example, the first chapter of Genesis, which is the most often quoted one, contains an entirely different creation story in an entirely different sequence from the second chapter of Genesis. And you put them side by side, you discover a couple of things. In the first chapter, for example, Adam and Eve are created simultaneously by God. In the second chapter, we do it all over again, except this time, Adam is created out of the dust of the earth. And then when we've got Adam, then God plants fruit trees. Then he causes a river to water those trees in Eden. Then he gives Adam a little job to do, and the job to do is to name every single animal on the earth. Now, that took Linnaeus about 18 years, but somehow Adam manages to get that over.
Quick study. That afternoon,
then he falls asleep, which I don't think is terribly surprising. Then the rib comes out, and then we get Eve. Now, those two stories, I don't bring up the conflicts between those two to ridicule Genesis or a literal reading of it. I simply point out, no matter how you read it, you've got to approach it with a degree of interpretation. And the way that I approach it as a Christian is the way that an awful lot of scientists who also are believers approach it, and that is to say that if you believe Genesis is literally true, it was an explanation of an inerrant explanation in the view of many believers of the relationship between the Creator and the created. Not a work of natural history, but a work of theological relationships. And if you understand it to be literally true in that sense, then the evolution myth, if you want to call it, doesn't supplant it. It explains the scientific details of it.
Our phone is 1-800-423-8255. Kenneth Miller is our guest, a religious biologist whose new book is called Finding Darwin's God. You could say he has both sides of the argument. 1-800-423-8255. Ted is on the line.
Yes, thanks. I think I'm going to enjoy reading Ken Miller's book, even though I probably have some disagreements with it. But there are a lot of people out here who are educated religious believers who look to science as itself a testament to God's own creative design for nature. You spoke earlier about the Kansas decision. And that decision, the standards that were laid down there, are crafted in such a way to prevent someone like Ken Miller from charting a middle path between biblical fundamentalism and the atheistic scientism of Dan Dennett. The passage I have right here in front of me from their book, Science and Creationism, lumps people like myself, who see in nature testimony to God's existence, into the same category with the biblical literalists. And I note also Dan Dennett's book is cited here at the back of the volume. This is produced by the National Academy of the Sciences, funded by our federal government. And it's very frustrating, I think, to listen to someone like Dan Dennett who says, if you really appreciate science and its findings, you have to be an atheist. I mean, I don't have to be an atheist if I love science and find it to be
Absolutely not. And I think if Dan Dennett were here, he'd take exception to what you just said. He's saying, no, I didn't exactly say that. But I think it's incontrovertible that when you read Dan's works and when you read the works of Provine and Dawkins, you'd come to the exact same conclusion that you just did. And I think that's one of the things that people who are seriously concerned about both religion and science have to be on guard against.
Ted, are you taking any exception from Ken Miller?
Well, I think, Chris, you're pointing to the key issue here of how does science and theology fit together. And I would take some issue. I think I hear Ken speaking of something of the classical tradition of Western thinking, Western philosophy, and perhaps he would side with some of the standard arguments for God's existence based upon reflection upon nature, not on any kind of commitment of faith, but just on nature.
I think, Ted, there are ways to do that. I have a very close personal friend and scientific colleague at Washington University named Ursula Goodenough, who's written a marvelous book called The Sacred Depths of Nature. And that book is exactly a meditation on the sort of thing that you think, sort of thing that you just described. And I certainly don't reject that at all. My question in the book was basically trying to say, rather than derive from nature the sorts of things that you described, let's take that very hard-edged orthodox religious view. I regard that as the greatest challenge and see if it fits with Darwin. And essentially what I argue is that it does.
Ted, I suspect you're on the same page.
I'm not sure, but can I ask a question here? What do you make of the claim that there is no growing complexity over time in evolution?
Well, I think it's clear that the claim is nonsense.
Thank you. Yes.
And the one of the standard arguments against evolution is that it cannot generate complexity. Well, I'm sorry. First of all, not only can it, but we understand at a molecular level very well how this happens. It happens by gene duplication, by a process known as exaptation or preadaptation. Exaptation is a Steve Gould term. By which proteins and structures actually acquire additional functions. And over time and under appropriate selection conditions, one of the ways in which natural selection and evolution can move is towards increasing complexity. There just isn't any question about it.
Ted, thank you. 1-800-423-8255. We're talking about Ken Miller and his book, Finding Darwin's God. Ward is on the line.
Hello, Christopher.
Welcome, Ward.
Hello. I hear people talking about these things for years and skirting around a couple of basic issues. On one hand, if you take fundamentalism or religion orthodoxy far enough, it gets scary, and so with modern science, without ethics, with genetics.
Ward, I'd agree that any strong-held belief, whether it's a social belief or political, taken far enough, gets scary.
Well, the one thing I'd like to bring out is within religions, the fundamentalists or orthodox religions, whether you have in Islam, you have Sufism and orthodox Islam. Within Christianity, you have the saints. Within Judaism, you have the mystics and then the orthodox. That I don't think that you have to throw out spirituality, a belief in God, miracles, survival of bodily death, these kinds of things wholly. Sacrifice all of spirituality and religious beliefs with what I call creation myths. And what we're talking about here are a belief in creation myths where things that were utterly sublime tried to be described in ways that a concrete mind could understand them.
Exactly.
And it's if one does not understand paradoxical language, and the use of paradox and the use of metaphor and image and myth, then one's really out to lunch.
No, I couldn't agree with you more. And this has actually been in religious writing for a very long time.
Hinduism, Buddhism, they all have creation myths, and they don't mistake the map for the territory.
Exactly. Augustine, in the 4th century A.D., made exactly that point, and that is what the Bible does is to tell us about our relationship with the Creator. What it doesn't tell us, it doesn't give us a textbook of what today we would call science or natural history.
Ward, thank you. 1-800-423-8255. Robert is calling from Memphis.
Memphis, Missouri.
Memphis, Missouri.
Okay, I've got two things. I think that your guest has overstated two concepts. One, the idea that evolution is the backbone of science, as though science would totally fall apart if evolution were questioned.
I think what I said is the backbone of biology, but we'll let this go. Go ahead.
Even there.
Actually, let me jump in. You said it would fall apart if it was questioned. Absolutely not. Evolution is, in fact, questioned all the time, and it should be questioned. Everything in science should be questioned all the
time.
Well,
if it were not only questioned, but people say, hey, we're rejecting this. Scientists say that. They go right on. The practical applications of biology or any other science would progress at the same pace. They don't, when someone's working on a bacteria, they're not sitting there thinking, boy, I got to remember this has something to do with evolution.
Robert, with all due respect, that's exactly what people have to do these days. We now have the whole genome sequences of about 15 microorganisms.
We're not going to heal diseases without evolution?
Oh, well, let me put it this way. Let's put this specific. You say we're not going to heal diseases without evolution. Without an understanding and appreciation of evolution, we're going to do a lousy job of healing diseases. Evolution,
I think that's
evolution,
to make a statement
well,
like this.
Well, it's also medical scientific fact. One of the main concerns, for example, in designing the three-drug therapy that is used to combat AIDS is trying to set up ways to prevent the HIV virus from evolving resistance to that three-drug cocktail. Evolution is at the core
about,
of the therapy.
If all you mean by evolution is that organisms undergo change, but you're talking about the whole scheme of evolution.
Well,
I'm saying that I think they go to the laboratory, they see results in the laboratory, they compare, they contrast, they talk back and forth, and they come to solutions, and the theory of evolution has absolutely nothing to do with those results.
Well, I couldn't disagree with you more.
Well,
Robert, do you come at this as a layman, as a scientist, as a...
Well, I come in as a layman. I am a pastor. There was one other thing I wanted to question about what he'd said, but I'm just saying that I'm also a student of philosophy. That is just logically absurd and ridiculous to assume that we're not going to discover needed information concerning diseases unless we believe in the overall theory of evolution.
No, Robert, I didn't say scientists don't believe in theories. You accept them on the basis of the evidence. But
well, whatever,
you're from Missouri. I came very close to taking a job at your wonderful state university in Columbia about 12 years ago. They were recruiting me for the plant biology, which is the field that I do my laboratory work in. And just to sort of put why evolution is important in a Missouri context, an awful lot of farmers these days are growing genetically engineered corn, which has a toxin in it called BT toxin. It's great stuff because it defeats the corn borer and it makes it possible to grow those crops without pesticides and without getting harmful chemicals into the diet. I think genetically modified foods are wonderful. Some of your callers may disagree. But one of the things that people realized right on was that evolution of resistance to this wonderful natural insecticide, BT, was going to be a problem. So farmers actually have to sign up to leave part of their fields alone and not use genetically modified crops in there to create a reservoir to prevent the rapid evolution of resistance. And the fact is, you said, if it's just change in the species, that is exactly what evolution is. It's exactly what Darwin said it was, and it's exactly the engine that drives the whole
system. Robert, you're saying you can have the science without the theory.
Yeah, microevolution is what some people have called what he's describing, but macroevolution is this total overall theory of non-life to life and the very...
No, that's the origin of life, sir.
What's that?
Macroevolution is not the non-life to life. That's the origin of life, which is really...
Well, I'm saying, though, the overall theory that would incorporate the initial chemical makeup and set it all the way through, that's macroevolution. You're talking about changes that come about that we can observe, we can define. All of that macroevolution is not necessary to understanding any of that. That's observable stuff you can go to the laboratory and do, whether you're an atheist or a Christian.
Oh, there's no question.
Your point is taken, and I'm tickled you called. 1-800-423-8255. The Darwin's God connection with Kenneth Miller. Greg is on the line.
Hello.
Hello, Greg. Welcome.
It's gray, by the way, color. Chris, I'm very impressed by Professor Miller, and I've been working on a documentary about the impact of El Nino on the Galapagos, on the life forms in the Galapagos. Mm-hmm. And as such, I had to learn a little bit about Darwin and why the Galapagos is special, and also something about Victorian science and natural selection. And I'd like to make a point about natural selection and the origin of species. Darwin wasn't the first person to discover the concept of evolution.
Absolutely not.
Origin of species describes basically, or talks about the mechanism, the rules, if you will, by which change occurs. He did not want to make a big deal out of evolution. My observation is that he was a religious man, at least in his younger days, and became an atheist only after the death of his children.
Well, I think you can make the case, and his biographers have done this for years, that Darwin never became an atheist, as you put it. He constantly agonized over the issue of religion, and various times he said, sometimes he described himself as an agnostic. Sometimes he says, in the general sense, you could call me a theist. He ended The Origin of Species with that wonderful quote about there being grandeur in this view of life, with its first powers having been first breathed by the Creator into one form or several. And I agree with all the things that you've just said. Darwin actually didn't much like the word evolution. He preferred descent with modification, which in many respects scientifically is a more accurate description.
Or transmutation of species.
Exactly. I appreciate your comments very much. Thanks.
The other interesting problem we have, I think, with regard to religion is that we all have these paradigms that we live within. Science has its paradigms and religion has its paradigms, and maybe we would do well to look at the paradigms of religion during Darwin's time, then we don't get so immediately involved in being defensive.
I couldn't agree with you more. One of the points that I actually made in my book, which really hasn't come up for discussion today, is that in Darwin's time, not only did he have a thoroughly, of course, Victorian conception of religion, but he also had a Victorian conception of physics and the nature of the material universe. And one of the great things that's happened in this century is that we understand that at its basics, the physics that underlies living systems is non-determinate, is influenced by quantum events. Now, we don't really have the time to go into this in the same way I
did
in the book.
That's part two.
Why this influences our understanding of evolution, but the interesting thing is it does, and it does in fundamental ways, and it does in ways that allows for the sort of creativity that a believing person has to think is available in the evolutionary process.
Great. Thanks for the call. 1-800-423-8255. It's the Darwin's God connection. Chooks is on the line. Hello, Chooks.
Hello, Chris.
Welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, I have some questions for your guest, and I will also say something on your comments on Genesis account chapters 1 and 2. But first, let me ask you, did you document in your book the fact that Darwin denounced the theory of evolution on his deathbed?
No, I didn't document it, Chooks, for the very simple reason, and that is that the best scholarship into Darwin's life suggests that the story is false. It was made up.
Made up by who?
It was made up. I'm sorry, I've forgotten the name of the lady, but there was a woman who was prominent in Victorian society, and after Darwin's death, about 10 years after his death, became a public lecturer and speaker in Britain of some renown, spreading the story that at his bedside, Darwin had recanted from evolution. All of Darwin's survivors, including his son and his wife, said that there was that person who set themselves up as a bedside witness was never there, that Charles Darwin never did such a thing, and the story, therefore, is apocryphal.
So you believe, in fact, that he didn't do that. And if you didn't document that, I think it is a serious omission in that, even if you think it's false and was probably propagated by another person, I think you would have documented it and just said exactly the same thing you said now.
Chooks, I think he is just de-documented.
Yeah, what I've said basically is that Darwin scholars universally think the story is made up. It's not given wide credence. It doesn't appear in most biographies of Darwin, therefore I didn't address it.
I like, as you do, the closing and slightly ambiguous but beautifully crafted last lines of The Origin of Species. Can I quote them from your book?
Go right ahead.
There is grandeur in this view of life, with its several powers having been originally breathed by the Creator into a few forms or into one, and that whilst this planet has gone cycling on according to the fixed law of gravity, from so simple a beginning, endless forms, most wonderful and most beautiful, have been and are being evolved. Ken Miller, it's enormously interesting to keep hammering at this subject from different angles, and you've given us a lot of new stuff to think about. Kenneth Miller's book is called Finding Darwin's God, A Scientist's Search for Common Ground Between God and Evolution. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And we can take it up again whenever. We had help today from Glenn Alexander, John Hoder, George Hicks, Rebecca Smuckler, and Kim Bichari. Thanks to all. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR, Boston.